and I just learned the best spell of all.
What's that?
Sleep.
Welcome back to My Alchemical Bromance. This is Eric Arneson, and today I'm here with Andrew Watt, who is a blogger, an artist, and a consultant. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me today.
Delighted to be here, Eric.
I came across your stuff on Twitter, I think, primarily because you were sewing thing. Well, actually, it was the Neo-Orphic hymns that I came across, which we'll get to later. But what also got me really interested is on your blog, you've got all of this great stuff that you've sewed. And as a fellow occultist and sewer, I suppose the first question that I have is, what do we call ourselves sewers? Is that what we are? Are we tailors?
Ah, it's an excellent question. You know, there's this word seamstress.
Yeah.
But we're not seamsters. There's no seamsters union that you can belong to. And I don't know that I would characterize myself as a tailor. I think that being a tailor involves a level of proficiency in altering clothes, in making pre-made clothes fit better, in being able to design an outfit from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
So sewer is probably the right word. The only trouble is that when you type it, it looks like sewer, and we're definitely not sewers.
Well, speak for yourself. I don't think sewer is a very, and it also, it kind of sounds like a farmer, you know?
Yes.
Like he's out sowing seeds. So we don't have a really good word for that in English, I guess. I also feel like a tailor is going to have a lot of, like, there's a lot of training. There's a lot of skill that you have to be able to, like, make a suit from scratch in order to be a tailor.
I think that that's right. I think that if you know how to make a suit from scratch, and I have done it, and I will not wear that suit in public. not because it has any sort of magical properties. I mean, in a sense, it does, but, and we'll talk about that later, but I don't think I look good in it, even though I followed all of the rules as I understood them. I've done it once.
Uh-huh.
At some point, I'm going to do it again, but not yet.
Well, that's more advanced than I ever got. I have altered lots of jackets and pants and shirts and things, but I've only made one pair of pants from scratch, and they were more like pajama pants, and I made them for a friend, and they turned out okay. They were a little small. I know what I did wrong now, but it was my first attempt. And then I also made myself a hat, which was way too big. So,
knitters go through exactly the same problem.
You know,
my mom has been making the same wool pattern of a Navy watch cap from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of comes in four or five different sizes, but she's old enough now that she starts it and she can't remember whether she's doing a small or a large or a medium. And then she realizes two-thirds of the way through, oh, I've been switching back and forth between medium and small, or between extra large and large.
So the size is always a surprise.
The size is definitely always a surprise.
I feel like that is my current level of creating clothes from scratch.
There is a list from the Middle Ages of the seven practical arts.
Uh-huh.
And it's masonry, it's hunting or warfare, it's carpentry, it's for some reason I can't pull them up right at the moment, but one of them is vestaria. It is, mm-hmm, essentially taking a sheep, shearing it, and going all the way to a set of clothes at the end. All of the different practical arts involved in that.
Oh my god, that's a lot of work. I mean, just the practice, just like getting wool from like shearing a sheep, you know, getting the lanolin out. I don't even know how they do that. There must be some kind of boiling and drying process or something.
Boiling and drying, and in some parts of the world they leave the lanolin in because it helps increase the waterproofing and the wind resistance of the finalized fabric or knit work.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Well, so how did you get started with the sewing?
We mentioned before that for a long time I was a middle school teacher. For the last dozen years of my life, I was involved in a variety of efforts to try to update and modernize the curriculum. For part of that time, it was bringing in computer science to history and English classrooms. And for some of the time, it was starting up a makerspace. And somebody gave our makerspace a sewing machine. And I had to learn how to use it. There were great tutorials on YouTube. There were great books, articles. I read an enormous amount. And as it so happened, I was also working my way through the curriculum of one of the various magical orders. And I had to make the sash that goes from one shoulder to the hip and then down. And essentially, it's a deacon's stole from the Roman Catholic Church. You know, it's got, you know, it's about 4 inches wide and it goes up over the shoulder from somewhere near the ankle and comes back across the back. There's a little tab at the hip that holds the front and back together. Mm-hmm. Pretty simple pattern. And yet you're assembling it out of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 pieces, maybe 12 pieces in all. And essentially you assemble everything backwards and inside out, and then you do what's known as turning. You take the whole thing and you turn the thing that you've assembled inside out so that it's now outside out and inside in, and suddenly you have a stole, and it doesn't look anything like what you thought it was going to look like because your seams aren't quite straight, or you haven't marked something properly, or you haven't ironed something properly, and suddenly you realize, oh, making clothing is an exercise in practical topology. It's literally designed to stretch fabric in different ways, and as it does so, it's stretching your brain in various ways.
Yeah, I had that experience too. I've described it this way before. I always think of sewing as inside out floppy geometry. Because you really have to think about how everything is going to go together. There's restrictions in, I guess they aren't always restrictions, they're just properties of the cloth, like how sharp can you get a corner, or what direction does it stretch in. I think a lot of people who never have to sew anything never really think about the fact that, like, different types of fabrics stretch in different directions, different amounts.
Yeah, and some of that stretch is a property of the material of the thread, and some of it is a property of how it's woven, and some of it is a property of both thread and weaving process.
Yeah.
I mean, most cotton fabric, which is probably the easiest stuff to find in the U.S. these days, fancy wool is hideously expensive, and you usually have to special order it. But nearly all of it is simply straight side to side, up and down weaving. It's square, essentially. And the whatever tension it has comes from shifting the sides of the fabric around a little bit. And then knit and woven stuff behaves very, very differently. A t-shirt is knit fabric, and denim is woven. So that gives people who aren't familiar with working with fabric a sense of it, that a t-shirt has a lot of stretch in it, and your jeans probably don't have a lot unless you got the kind that's 4% spandex.
Yeah, girl jeans. And also
some boy jeans too.
True. And isn't denim usually a twill pattern as well, right? So it's got like a diagonalness. So it's not necessarily square. It's usually diagonal in the knit. So if you're wearing jeans right now, take a look at them. You'll see.
Yeah, there's the grid on jeans is sort of diagonal to it.
So the thing that I really love about it, and, you know, the more I look around, the more I find other occultists who are doing sewing and other fabric arts. But it seems like there's so much more attention being given to to people who have magical practices, who are like, you know, making wands and jewelry and their pentacles and their crystal balls and their circles and like all of this other stuff. And it feels like that there isn't enough appreciation of the craftsmanship and the practice and the kind of the fun of sewing your tools. So I'm just sort of wondering, like, have you come across interesting things that you've decided to sew that have helped you in your practice that nobody else seems to be doing?
Yeah, I belong to one of John Michael Greer's various order projects. Mm-hmm. I belong to the Druidical Celtic Golden Dawn, and I had to make a set of banners. I've now made the same set of banners twice. No, three times. And, it's this broad expanse of black fabric with three rays of light coming out of the center of a trilithon, three stones.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another much more complicated one, which is two interlocking squares. One of them is green and one of them is yellow, and they overlap in sort of a knotwork pattern. Making those two banners radically improved the quality of my temple space.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And so I have the prototypes. I have the ones that I made first. And I did them based on Greer's designs.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he had an actual set of banners. He hasn't talked about the set that I gave him one year for Christmas, sort of as thanks for starting the order. And maybe he'll talk about that at some point. Maybe he won't. But another fellow in the order who lives out in California bought a pair of these, and he had a chance to work with somebody else in the order, and they hung them. And they said that both of them were having a conversation, and then they just sort of stopped talking and realized we're not behaving in temple space the way that we should. And
right.
they had to take the banners down before they could continue their conversation. They had to basically close down the temple space that they had created because the banners were vibrating at one another east and west across the room where they were meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, what they're supposed to do.
That's great. It worked.
It worked. You get a really competent occultist like John Michael Greer who designs the emblems, and then you actually execute them in, not in anything particularly fancy, cotton cloth and some, what are they called, tassels hanging from the ends that help give it some weight and keep it hanging straight. And suddenly the symbols themselves are speaking to one another, and they're speaking to you on both conscious and unconscious levels.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I guess for me, like I haven't done any banners, but I sew like my own altar cloths, and the one thing that I've spent a lot of effort in is like making the perfect tarot card bag. So I have a tarot card bag design that sort of like wrap around, and it uses a pretty heavy fabric, and it keeps the cards protected because I always carry a deck with me, and
as one does.
Yeah, as one does. But it ends up it adds like this whole new level of connection to what you're working with, you know, when you're like, oh, I made all of this stuff. And even for, you know, really like probably the thing that anybody could get started with is you go down to your local fabric store and get, what do they call them? The quarter yards, like
fat quarters.
Yeah. You get the fat quarters of the planetary colors, and you can just cut those up to make, little tiny bags for like amulet bags or whatever. And I do that a lot. Like sometimes if I just have one of those days where I'm like, I'm going to make a Jupiter thingamajig, and I'll just put it all together in a little bag that I just sew up right on the fly.
Yeah. And essentially that is straight sewing. right?
Mm-hmm.
If you have a sewing machine, you can do it with a sewing machine. You take two squares of cloth, you flip them together, you sew a seam that is a U-shaped seam around those two squares,
mm-hmm.
and the top is the opening of the bag. You stuff whatever it is that you need that bag to contain. You turn it, right? We were talking mm-hmm. about turning earlier. You have to turn the bag inside out so that
right, like a pillowcase.
Like the seams, so that the seams are on the inside. It'll look really nice and clean, except for one raggedy edge. And you can then turn those raggedy edges inside and do what's known as a top stitch.
Mm-hmm.
And that bag will never come undone.
Yeah. And you can shove it full of, like, herbs if you're doing that kind of magic, or, you know, a paper amulet or rocks or whatever the hell fits in there, and it'll all stay.
Right.
Yeah.
And it comes back to some of our current theories about animist magic, that when you are activating a physical talisman like this, the fabric acts as the shell or the skin of a living creature, right? It's the thing that holds the organs inside, and the organs of this spirit that you're calling into the bag is going to use the silver ring inside as its heart, or it's going to use the chamomile as the liver, or the metaphor is imperfect, but I hope that I'm making myself understood, that the things that you put into the bag are the thing that is sort of calling the spirit and granting the energy to the spirit, but
right.
the fabric is the skin that's holding that thing together.
I love that analogy. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that makes really good sense. Yeah, I mean, that's totally, and then, you know, just, you know, the amount of effort you put into it. So when I do little things like that, I like to sew them by hand.
Absolutely.
Because it doesn't take too long. You know, I mean, if you get, you get pretty fast at it eventually, and it just has a personal feel to it. It's pretty interesting.
Yes. There's a book that has just come out, which I haven't even finished reading yet, and it's called The Geometry of Hand Sewing.
Ooh.
Hang on. It's not within reach. But the point of that book is that they've identified that most traditional stitches are actually built on a geometric grid. That if you learn the grid system, then you can learn to think of stitches as doing different kinds of activities. And that means that the stitching itself can be used as a way of calling a specific kind of spirit to do specific kinds of work.
Oh, that's fascinating. I'm thinking about that now. I mean, it's just it also, like, plays more into, like, the geometry, you know, the floppy geometry idea. But in addition, like, the stitch itself could have a shape that reflects, you know, a planetary influence or a planetary intelligence. I had not that's... even. That's really cool. I feel like there's a lot to explore in the intersection between sewing and magic.
There's an enormous amount to explore, and I think that by and large it is an unwritten magic, and I think that part of the reason why it's an unwritten magic is that it is so much work to do.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that, there was a shirt discovered in Norway when a glacier melted back. You know, there's global climate change at work.
Mm-hmm.
Enough of the glacier melted that they found a teenage kid's shirt. I feel for the mother who had to probably beat her child for coming home shirtless from the mountains of Norway. But the shirt got left on a rock somewhere, and it's been inside of a glacier for maybe 1,000 years. And the estimate, based on what we know about production techniques, estimated that that shirt contained around 700 to 800 hours of human labor.
Oh, that is so insane.
Right? Shearing the sheep, carding the wool, spinning it into thread, turning the thread onto the loom, turning the stuff that's on the loom into actual fabric, changing the fabric into pieces that can then be sewn together. 700 to 800 hours of work for one shirt. And then you put embroidery onto it and it's easily 1,000 hours.
Right.
Nope, nobody has time to write that down. But of course they're doing magic because that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing all of this enormous amounts of handwork in order to produce one garment. And it's boring work, so you're singing or you're telling stories while you're doing it. It is re-enchanting the world, as Gordon talks about, right? That making clothes and making things out of fabric is itself an act of enchantment.
You know, I absolutely agree with that. And I was just sort of thinking about, like, it's also a cooperative act, right? So this is like a pre-capitalist society, but the mom who like embroidered the shirt probably isn't the same as the person who sheared the sheep or the person who carded the wool. Like she might not even have spun the wool, even though she might have worked on the loom or whatever. Like this, it was probably like the entire village was needed to create that one shirt.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
And you also have to consider that an enormous amount of the labor is almost certainly slave labor, right?
Yeah.
That the amount of work that's involved in this is simply not going to be done by people who are at the top of the economic spectrum, but everybody needs to be involved in this work in some way or another.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, now so much of it, especially like... we tend to take clothing for granted so much now, and I guess I pay a lot of attention to this. I spent a little while as a bit of a clothes horse, and I really just sort of loved the experience of finding like really nicely made clothing. You know, stuff that's going to last forever, stuff that had obvious care put into it. Maybe not always stuff that was made by hand, but you can see now like everything is so automated. You know, robots make our clothes, basically.
I got a story to tell about that.
I
worked with a woman for a number of years, and her husband was a bespoke weaver. You'd call him up. You'd only find him by word of mouth. Guy didn't advertise, but you'd call him up and you'd say, I have the frames, the gilt frames for two chairs that probably came from Versailles or from Vincennes Palace. You know, they're Louis mm-hmm. XIV era chairs. And I want to make the blue fabric with the gold fleur-de-lis to match.
Wow.
And he would weave it. And, you know, his prices probably started at $300 or $400 a yard and went up from there.
Right. Oh, that's crazy.
So
what a cool job, though.
But he learned his trade in the north of England, in the weaving mills in the north of England, until it was too expensive to mm-hmm. make wool in Great Britain or to make cotton.
Mm-hmm.
The mill closed. The machines were sold, maybe sold for scrap. And what with one thing and another, he emigrated to America and started weaving here. 20 years go by. He gets a call. He is the only guy from his factory who's still in the weaving business, right?
Yeah.
The machines are now, I think, in Vietnam. I'm not going to get the places right, but the machines are now in Vietnam. And would he come to Vietnam and help teach people how to run these machines?
Mm-hmm.
10 years later, he goes to, I think, Mozambique, because it's too expensive to run the machines in Vietnam now. They have to go to a different country. So now they're in Mozambique.
Wow.
3 years later, he gets another call. Now they're somewhere in the back of beyond in China, and the weaving shop is in China. Same machines that he had worked on in 1963 in the north of England.
That's crazy.
Those machines were built out of cast iron parts in 1826.
Wow.
So here are these machines bumping around the world in various ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as they bump around the world, they are looking for a place where you can pay the workers pennies a day.
Right.
Because the machines were built at a time when you could only pay workers pennies a day in order to make a profit. So sooner or later, they're going to be scrap, or at least we can hope that they're going to be scrap.
Right, right, right. Yeah, that's...
Because as local wages rise, the owners of the machine go, oh, we can't do business here anymore. We got to sell them.
And they sell. Oh, God. And it's totally sell. They're slave labor machines. Like, they're machines that basically run on slave labor. Yeah. Wow.
And that means that you have no idea where or when the machines were built that make your T-shirt or your mosquito netting when you're in some tropical country without good water supplies, or you have no idea.
You really don't. Yeah, but I mean, from what I've heard, like, a lot of mass-produced clothing, they have these... they have basically like these computerized cutting and sewing machines that do a lot of sort of the big work, and then detail work is sort of left to individuals with sewing machines, I think.
Do you want more insight into your next big ritual? Do you need to shatter mental blocks in your business pursuits? It's time for the tarot to crack open the eggshell of your reality. This is Eric Arneson, co-host of My Alchemical Bromant and the guy behind Arnomancy. I am now offering live online tarot readings over Skype. I even got a brand new webcam. Visit arnomancy.com to learn more and use the code BROMANCE to get 25% off your next live online tarot reading. Remember, that's arnomancy.com. Check it out today.
Do you own a serger? I don't own a serger. They're also called overlock machines.
I do not own a serger. I've looked at how they work, and I mean, sergers are pretty neat, but usually I just use my sewing machine with a, and I do a, what is it, like an overcast stitch and then a straight stitch, and then I trim it manually. It's slightly more work, but I think it does about the same thing.
Yeah, pretty much. But the notion that there's a machine that's capable of doing the straight stitch, the zigzag stitch, and the trimming all at the same time, like, that is the thing that makes modern, ready-to-wear, off-the-shelf clothing from everything from the Gap and Old Navy possible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, my sewing machine, it has a lot of programmable modes, but it's all just, like, stitches, you know, so it's still pretty cool. So then have you made your own ritual robes and that sort of stuff?
I have. And I wrote an article. That's one of the reasons why we're talking now, which is called Neglect Not the Robe.
Oh, yes. I remember that article. how did that experience go?
A huge part of the process was finding what pattern to use. That you go to the Simplicity pattern in Joann Fabrics, or you look online for a pattern, and there's not a whole lot to choose from. Like, there's not very many people that sell wizard's robes patterns that you feel like, oh, I totally look awesome in this, and this feels like the right robe.
Well,
but it comes back.
You have to get something where your sleeves aren't going to catch on fire.
You have to find something that your sleeves don't catch on fire, or, and this is the solution that I finally hit on, is that you have to adopt what I don't call them this, but maybe this is the right language for them. You have to adopt temple gesture. Like, one of my teachers said that all ritual actions are functional in origin, but ontological in reflection.
Ooh, I like that.
In other words, you start out by making things or doing things because it's the functional way to do it. But once you think about them, you realize that there's a deeper or more intentional meaning behind them. If you wear a robe in temple or in your magical circle that has big sleeves, you have to move more slowly. You have to hold your hands in such a way that one hand is catching the sleeve, while the other hand is passing over the flames on the altar. You there's a heightened awareness that comes from wearing a robe in temple space.
Well, it's like a practice in mindfulness, right? It's
absolutely
one of those basic meditation tricks that we're all supposed to learn when we're first starting out. Like, how do you be mindful? How can you be mindful in temple? How can you be mindful in your ritual? But if you need to be mindful in order to keep from catching on fire or accidentally sitting on your incense burner or whatever, like, so I totally see where that comes from. You know, it is functional in origin, but what was it? Ontological in reflection? Is that what you'd said?
Ontological in reflection.
Yeah, I love that phrase, temple gesture. I hope that that's in your blog post.
I don't know that it is, but it should be, and maybe I'll have to write an article about temple gesture.
Yeah, I think you should. I'll remind you if you run out of. There's so much to explore in this sewing stuff. I feel like we could probably talk for an entire hour about it, but I really, really want to ask you about some of this other stuff. Like, I really want to talk about your Neo-Orphic hymns, which I love. They are so well put together. What led you to those? Or how about this? Let's back up a little bit. Let's assume that our listeners have never read any of your Neo-Orphic hymns. So why don't you kind of like describe them?
Well, Thomas Taylor in 1775 did the first English translation of the Orphic hymns, which are from ancient Greece, and they are, his versions anyway, are very loose translations. They're in rhyming metrical poetry like you would find in the doggerel verse of the 1700s. And I thought, oh, this is really elegant. This is a great way to do ritual. And several other magical practitioners had recommended his.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this is pretty good, but I'm a poet. And I believe genuinely in the power of words to shape mind. And I genuinely believe that not only do words shape mind, but that acts of creativity is part of the way that we connect with magical ideas and magical entities. So the natural response for me was, how do I take the general themes of the Orphic hymns as I currently understand them and write my own versions of them?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time I was working my way through Rufus Opus's Red Work, Black Work. I've now forgotten what order they go in, but his course of study using the Trithemian rite, otherwise known as the art of drawing spirits into crystals, or the art of, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the system that's outlined in his Seven Spheres book.
That's right.
Okay.
And so I thought, okay, I'm going to write my own set of hymns, partly because I figured this was a way of translating what the spirits were saying to me into my own language, and two, when you write a poem, particularly a poem that has to follow rigid rules about meter and rhyme, you're training your brain. You're training your brain to think along particular imaginative lines.
Okay. And that makes sense. So then, and you've done all seven.
Yeah, Thomas Taylor translated all 87 hymns. I've only done the seven that are specific to the planets. I've done others, but they're not really published.
How much of the...
Some of them aren't publishable.
Oh. how much of Thomas Taylor's work did you use in your versions? Are most of them entirely of your own doing, or did you use Thomas Taylor for inspiration?
I definitely use Thomas Taylor for inspiration. I mean, I'm very much aware that great writers steal, but mediocre writers borrow, and I'll leave it to the reader to decide whether I'm borrowing or stealing.
Well, I mean, you know, so like for some of the deities, Thomas Taylor has like multiple hymns, you know, so there's like four or five of them dedicated to Zeus. I think there's a couple to Aphrodite. You know, at least I haven't actually gone back and looked since I first sort of put the hymns together that I use. But I know that in, you know, the incredibly battered printout that I have next to my altar with the Thomas Taylor hymns on it, the Aphrodite hymn is incredibly long. And a lot of the other ones are short. Like Ares, for instance, is incredibly brief. Are yours more uniform in length? Like, did that enter into it at all? Do you sing them?
I don't sing my own. I sing Thomas Taylor's.
Uh-huh.
But I haven't found the tune or the song that goes with mine. On the other hand, they are all the same length, and they all follow the same metrical scheme, which is called an ode. It's three verses. There are 10 lines per verse. They're all in iambic pentameter. There's a rhyme scheme, which I think goes A, B, A, B, C, D, E, C, D, E.
Uh-huh.
Within each verse.
That's pretty, that's nice.
And there's both a rigidity of that kind of form and a really nice structure to them. I found that three verses was about the right length to get my head in the game.
Mm-hmm.
That I really liked laying them out in that way.
And you have them all collected and published as an ebook?
They're not as an ebook. They're simply a page on my website, which I think is andrewbwatt.com/poetic-catalog/the-neo-Orphic hymns. And if you search Google for the Neo-Orphic hymns and my name, you'll probably find them.
I will absolutely put a link to them in the show notes. You mentioned that you'd worked through the Seven Spheres system. Rufus Opus,
right.
Seven Sphere System. How did you find that? Like, what was that experience like?
Some parts of it were very hard. Some parts of it were easy. I would say that it led to some of the most productive times during my career and some of the most successful times mm-hmm. during my career. I mean, Rufus Opus says that I forget whether it's in the book or not, or whether it was in the course material that he published while he was still writing the book. But he said something to the effect of the black work, the white work, and the red work is followed by the green work,
mm-hmm.
which is actually living out that experience in daily life and producing wonders.
Right.
And I produced wonders. That period when I was writing these hymns and doing this work were enormously productive. I had my first art show as an artist. I started up a makerspace in my school. They originally told me we were going to have a budget of like $10,000, and we wound up having something more like $800, and we did it anyway.
Wow.
And brought the project in under budget anyway.
So when you talk about the makerspace, like what sort of makerspace was it? Did you have?
For a while, we had a 3D printer.
Mm-hmm.
We had, which is, you know, another great way for magicians to think about topology. I like it less than sewing, but learning to think in three dimensions in terms of both an inside of an object and an outside of an object, to be able to visualize that and to plan for it and then to design the thing with the software is tremendously useful.
Mm-hmm.
Among other things, you also learn to become quite skilled with 3D modeling software, and learning to be familiar with modeling software can be a great gateway to astral projection, because if you can visualize it really clearly on a computer screen in 3D, it's much easier to imagine it when your eyes are closed.
Oh, for sure. That's a good insight, actually. One of the practices that I use is the art of memory, which is a lot of like 3D visualization, you know, visualization inside of spaces. one of the warnings that you get in a lot of the old texts about the Art of Memory is like you should start with real places because otherwise you're going to have difficulty, you know, putting together 3D spaces in your mind. And it's kind of along the same line, right? Like you build a 3D object, and when you get used to the structure, looking at it, even just looking at it on a screen or looking at it in a way that it can actually be created in the real world, it's easier to see in your mind later on.
Absolutely. And the tools are becoming more and more sophisticated in terms of what it is that you can do and what you can think about having in each space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a powerful tool for inventing those kinds of imaginary spaces that you use in Palace of Memory.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, you've got Memory Palace stuff on your blog.
I do.
So you've done work with this as well.
I have. I used it in part for teaching Latin for a number of years, and I found it was really effective. The kids that bought into the idea of Palace of Memory did much better on quizzes. They retained vocabulary for a longer period of time, developed much better skills in all of their classes.
Oh, yeah. I've actually been using it to learn Hebrew. So yeah, okay, but hold on. All right, so I'm scattering our topics all over the place. I want to just rewind a hair back to the seven spheres thing.
Sure.
So Rufus Opus's seven spheres, at least in the book version, there are props that you need, right? So you need like the circle of art, and you need all of those lamens that you hang around your neck. There are various bits and pieces that you have to,
sure, and make. You should totally store those objects in bags of the right color.
Right, but how did you make the objects? Did you just make them out of paper, or did you use a 3D printer for any of it, or what was your methodology?
I would say that a lot of that stuff was at the beginning of my exploration of makerspace stuff. Mm-hmm. And the really cool thing about the art of drawing spirits into crystals, especially if, you know, your mundane job is, we'd like you to build us a makerspace, is that you ask the spirits for help with building this makerspace, and the spirits go, look, here's an opportunity to get a sewing machine. Here's an opportunity to get a 3D printer.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really clear with me anyway, that paper lamens and simply a painted wooden stick as opposed to an actual piece of ebony were fine. That having the paper objects was totally okay with them. And I think that that's an important lesson, that you have to recognize that some spirits really want exactly the right material, and others of them are sufficiently helpful that they will let you do things to the best of your ability with the tools that you have, because they care about the communication, not about the materia.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, especially in like the older grimoire stuff, I think that's becoming more and more accepted, or at least well known, as we discover more and more of like working man style grimoires or lower class style grimoires, like the one that Joseph Peterson just put out, Spiritum Sanctum. Oh wait, it's sitting right there. No, it's not. Where did I? Oh, yeah, this guy. It's called Secrets of Solomon, the Venetian Inquisition one that he just put out, where a lot of the pentacles and stuff are just so much simpler than you get in the more sophisticated Solomonic grimoires. You really sort of are brought to the realization that, like, oh yeah, some of these incredibly difficult setups with like lion skin belts and golden chalices and bronze vessels, like that's rich man's magic.
It is rich man's magic, and it is also the case that at least some of the spirits in each of these classes, and there's this bit in one of the grimoires, no, it's not in the grimoires, it's in Iamblichus, mm-hmm. where he says, you know, there's the god, and then the god has a variety of archons and archons that are presently ruling,
mm-hmm.
and archangels and angels and intelligences and spirits and demigods and ascended souls that serve. And I have no idea often whether I'm talking with, hello, whether I'm talking with
mm-hmm.
a spirit or an ascended soul or an archangel, or whether I'm talking with the god, but they're borrowing one another's charism. But you're talking with something, and the something is saying, the paper ring is fine. Here's the next step that you should do in order to make the makerspace or your career a success.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing, that piece of advice that they offer is, in fact, exactly the right thing at the right time.
Right. Yeah. That is... that's actually really cool that you sort of incorporated that work into your sort of career path or everyday life. Like, I like that a lot. I don't know that I've done that as much. I haven't completed the Seven Spheres system, but I've done most of it.
I don't think you ever entirely complete it.
Yeah.
I think that you leave behind elements of the system as you become more familiar with it. I don't do very much more than light some incense and say the Orphic hymn of the day.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that I'm out of communication because I haven't done the full ritual setup. You need to do the ritual setup at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and your practice sort of simplifies over time as you develop a more familiar relationship.
Right, right. Yeah, I've definitely seen that. And then, so you also mentioned that you've gone through Jason Miller's Strategic Sorcery course.
Which I think is a brilliant course.
And yeah.
There's a lot of really elegant material in there.
What is it like? Is that too broad a question? So let me ask. So is the Strategic Sorcery course sort of like an introductory course? Does it sort of like build a framework for a daily practice, or does it build a framework for like operative sorcery? Like how does he sort of go about it?
I would say that there's a fair bit of his course which comes out of his encounters with Tibetan shamanism and Buddhist practice in, I think, Nepal.
Wow.
And I don't want to say that it's Buddhist or that it's Nepalese or that it's cultural appropriation that he's borrowed. I would say rather that there's a lot of material in this course that comes from squinting at Buddhist practice in magical circles and squinting at Western magical traditions and going, there are similarities here.
Mm-hmm.
And those similarities are sufficient that we can recognize that meditation is one of the critical elements of any magical or spiritual practice.
Yeah.
You, as hateful and as hurtful and as awful as it is to sit with your back straight, just breathing for 10 to 15 to 20 minutes every single day, that is at the heart of any successful magical practice, because you need to get that level of calm and that level of peace in yourself before you're going to develop any of the other senses, before any of your other experiences are really going to open up.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you have to keep going back to it too. Like
you do, as annoying as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Deb Castellano who talks about how awful it is for her to be a meditator, and I read her and I nod along with her and I say, oh, I feel that. I totally get that.
But you still gotta do it.
You still gotta do it.
Yeah.
And it yields enormous results.
It does.
doesn't mean that it's fun, but it yields enormous results.
And it bleeds over into everything too, right? Like meditation leads to mindfulness, which leads to, you know, stuff like the temple gesture that you were talking about earlier. Like it's so core. It also teaches you how to recognize altered states of consciousness and even enter into them more easily. Like it's so essential to like all of the magic stuff. It's, yeah, man, that is annoying.
When I was a school teacher, I had several years I had to teach a unit on Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I usually said on the first day of our unit on Buddhism, all we're going to do is we're going to do the core practice of Buddhism, which is to meditate for 15 minutes, which basically means we're going to sit here quietly and just breathe for 15 minutes.
And this was middle school?
This was middle school.
Hmm. How did that go?
Well, I'll tell you that almost every time that I did this, and I probably did this for about 6 years straight, some student would come up to me afterwards. This was probably an eighth grader, maybe a ninth grader, but usually an eighth grader. And they would say, Mr. Watt, you know I would never do this at school, but why does sitting in meditation for 15 minutes feel exactly like I feel after I've gotten high from marijuana?
Mm-hmm.
and I would just laugh and I would say, you mean you're smoking such bad weed that it just feels exactly like breathing properly for 15 minutes?
Yeah.
So that should give people who don't meditate a chance to understand that if you sit a group of middle schoolers down who have never meditated before and you give them 15 minutes of silence to breathe and you make a covenant with them that there will be no interruptions, that if anybody feels like they can't possibly sit still for 15 minutes, that they have to get up and leave and not disrupt anybody else. You have to come to certain agreements ahead of time, but that modern students are so jazzed up all the time that 15 minutes of silence and peace and breathing feels like getting high. It feels like finally relaxing and being at peace and being at home in your own skin.
Yeah.
And 15 minutes is all that it takes for a middle schooler who's that jumped up and that crazy.
We should make all of our students meditate, huh?
Well, I think that that's problematic in other ways, because you can encourage a level of mindful meditation in schools. And I think that one of the risks of mindful meditation to the exclusion of any other kind of practice, including prayer. I mean, I don't think that prayer necessarily belongs in schools. In fact, I don't think that it belongs in schools as an institutional thing.
Mm-hmm.
But people who meditate, who become perfectly at peace and calm under any sort of circumstance, are also capable of deciding to perpetrate all kinds of evils because, well, I'm calm and I'm at peace with myself, so I can make this perfectly horrible decision and not feel any qualms or like I'm committing a moral atrocity.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a danger. I never really thought about that being a danger in meditation, but yeah, I mean, I guess I could see that.
I think there is a reason that mindfulness meditation is such a big part of modern corporate training. If you're at a high level in a company and you're a highly skilled meditator, but you can still sign the paperwork that fires 3,500 people, they're okay with that.
God, that's... Andrew, that is dark. But I think that is something to keep in mind. That's something that I'm going to have to think about.
Good. Yeah, it's worth it.
Okay.
It's worth it to think about it.
I'm going to meditate on this. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's still cool. I find it so hard to believe that you got middle school students to meditate. Like, I'm sure you did, but in my head, I'm trying to imagine what that must have looked like, and it's very difficult. I need a 3D printer. All right, so let's see. I guess that's... So, the last thing that I had on my list that I wanted to ask you about was astrological magic. Now, you went through the Rufus Opus's Seven Spheres course, which is all about sort of like planetary connection and connecting with different planetary energies. Did you do that before you started working with astrological magic, or was astrological magic sort of always there?
Oh, I think that astrology and astrological magic is something that you get called to rather than something that you decide to take up for yourself.
Oh, yeah?
I think that doing Rufus Opus's course put me on somebody's map. And I decline to say who.
Okay, but that's cool. But you don't have to.
But I think that if you engage in some sort of planetary magical practice, like Seven Spheres, that sooner or later, astrology is going to come running and say, it's my turn.
I could see that. I definitely would say that happens. Like, you basically are lighting up a beacon and saying, hey, look over here, I'm poking around in new realms.
Yeah, Gondor calls for aid, and it is time for you to show up.
How did you get started with it? Have you done any of like Christopher Warnock's courses or anything like that?
I'll say that I'm currently working my way through Chris Warnock's class, but I'm on homework number 4, and I've been on homework number 4, I don't know, for 3 or 4 years. So it's not going very fast. I think you could do his class a lot faster than I have been doing, but.
Well, I mean, I've seen you've got stuff that you've done about the deacons. It looks like, so you have something about like the solar movement through the deacons. And then you've also got some stuff that you've done with the Mansions of the Moon, right? Like you've got ebooks that you've published about those.
Yeah. So if you go to Amazon, there's ebooks of these sets of poetry.
Oh, and really? That's awesome.
And those are poems that you can use in both a devotional and a magical context to communicate with the angels of the mansions or the Hellenistic spirits that are associated with the deacons or the faces.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for my own part, I think they work. They certainly work for me.
Have you heard any feedback from others to see? Well, if they're working for other people?
I think there's one review online that says that somebody really enjoyed them. I'm not sure that they're using them in a magical context. I had somebody buy all 3 books on the same day from India. You know, if you put an ebook on Amazon, then apparently they can buy it in India. And this person, who I gather lives somewhere in the neighborhood of New Delhi, said, this is amazing. These work so well. And I haven't heard anything from him in 2 years. So I'm hoping he didn't blow himself up.
Oh, you know, maybe he just made $1 zillion and he's just too busy to be on the internet now with running all of his businesses and, you know.
Yeah, I can only hope.
Cashing in all of his lottery tickets.
I can only hope.
All right, well, I'll make sure to include links to your ebooks too, because those sound really interesting. Now, I used your lunar neo-Orphic hymn, and I thought it was great. I thought it was, it felt effective, and it was a nice addition to a lunar talisman ritual that I had put together. So I was
fantastic.
Really, yeah, I'm impressed with how well the neo-Orphic hymns work. So I'm totally, everybody should go read those right now. Stop listening to the podcast and go.
Well, I think we're currently in a Venus hour, right?
Hold on. I will look at what my...
You're probably in a different hour since you're on the other side of the country.
Yes, it's. I have a planetary clock on my altar that lights up according to the day and hour.
It's fantastic.
But it's also really sunny in here. So it looks like maybe Saturn.
Oh.
But there's nothing wrong with Saturn. I get along great with Saturn. And Saturn's in a good spot right now, lumbering along through Capricorn or whatever.
Let's give Saturn his due since he's currently in Capricorn.
Okay.
Ethereal Titan, time's own father, ancient of days through eternities vast, carry our spirits as light as feather, joining our present with future and past. You govern all perfection and decline, the seed in furrow and the harvest scythe, life's final stages and the gaping grave. With trudging step you walk the outmost line of seven heavens, where abysses writhe and tremble. Fear stalks the steps of the brave who venture to walk in your silent hall, and only ghosts dance in your groaning tomb. For everything that lives must have its fall. Nothing lasts forever which leaves the womb. Yet all that dies must in due course renew what now begins and moves towards completion. Each generation in turn goes to dust, as heat from the fire goes up the flue, and fuel becomes ashen dissolution. Even iron stoves crack and turn to rust. Always in like manner does time beat down every growing and every shrinking thing. Forgotten solitude follows renown, like cables unraveled to tangled string. Rhea's husband and Prometheus wise, who binds obstetric nature in his chains. Propitious hear these prayers at sacred rites, Lord Saturn, make our blameless lives the prize, and come, peaceful death, reuse our remains as fuel for future lives and future lights.
That is awesome. There's ideas in there that definitely remind me of the Thomas Taylor Orphic hymn, and then other stuff in there that feels very Wattish. You know, like I can see your experience in there as well. I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. That was great.
You're welcome. I think it's the first time it's ever been recorded, so thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, I'll put music to it and shit. It'll be great. when I started working through the seven spheres, I actually did Saturn first.
Brave one.
Well, you know, I've been doing ceremonial magic for like 20 years. And when I got in there, I was like, I feel good about Saturn. And it was a Saturday. And I was just like, this is it. I'm starting with Saturn. And it was great. It was a heavy, big experience, which definitely, you know, got me started. But, I don't feel bad for starting with Saturn. And I have always kind of had like, you know, I guess probably from reading Francis Yates, like I've had this experience, this image of Saturn as being sort of a fountain of creation and creativity, and not necessarily like the terrible greater malefic that we're told Saturn is now. You kind of get that in Thomas Taylor's Orphic Hymn, where he talks about Saturn in almost like this Neoplatonic way of being the progenitor of forms or something like that, which I always thought was really cool.
How does that one go? It's ethereal father, mighty titan here, great fire of gods and men whom all revere, mm-hmm. endowed with various counsel, pure and strong, to whom perfection and decrease belong, right? There's that idea of starting at perfection, and then the decline from perfection is the thing that belongs to Saturn.
Yeah.
And in a very Neoplatonic way, the idea is the eternal perfection, and its manifestation in physical reality is the decline.
Yeah, it falls further and further away from the original source and becomes baser and more material.
Yes.
Sort of and less real and more matter.
And there's that bit, I know it not from the original, but from the Marini Consorts mm-hmm. Album called The Secrets of the Heavens. Do you know this piece? It's
I don't. Marini Consorts.
The Marini Consort. This is a great album for magicians, but it is Renaissance music that follows the rules for what music of each of the spheres of the planets should sound like.
Oh, wow.
With an invocation that comes from Marsilio Ficino or other Renaissance sources. Starting each movement. So this is what Mars is like, followed by a Mars-like piece of music. This is what Jupiter is like, followed by a Jupiter-like piece of music. And the invocation to Saturn says, however, Plato placed the higher part of the soul under the authority of Saturn. You know, magic belongs to Mercury, but contemplation and the real powers of the soul, those belong to Saturn.
I love that.
It's a brilliant, brilliant album, and it's one that I wish were better known.
I will put a link to that in there, too.
Of course, with the 21st century, it's now possible to put the whole album, to download it from your favorite music store, mm-hmm. and have it on your phone, and you're listening to a playlist or whatever, and suddenly a piece from The Secrets of the Heavens comes on, and you look at your phone and you go, oh, it's Mars Hour, and the Mars piece is playing. It's like a ringtone from Mars saying, listen up and pay attention. I have something to tell you. It happens more frequently than you might imagine.
I believe it. I totally believe it. I mean, I use Holst's Planets pretty often.
Same
when I
thing.
Do ritual.
Same thing.
Yeah, I've got it on my phone, and I don't know that I've ever seen... I don't know that I ever really put my phone on shuffle, but maybe it's time. Audiomancy, right?
Audiomancy.
All right, Andrew, this has been such an incredible conversation. I'm so glad that we found each other on Twitter, or that I found you on Twitter. Whoever found whomever on Twitter, we did a good job. I really have enjoyed talking to you. We've talked about a lot of your work, which I'm going to link to. And I'm wondering if there are other places in particular that you would like people to find you on the internet.
My main blog is Andrew B. Watt. It's andrewbwatt.com.
Mm-hmm.
My Twitter handle is Andrew B. Watt, all one word. Those are probably the easiest places to find me.
All right.
If you're interested. And then, of course, there are books on Amazon. I am not the Andrew Watt that wrote all of the books about HTML and XML. That's somebody else. I think he's from Australia.
You got to put your middle initial in there.
Yeah. And I'm also not the Andrew Watt who used to date Rita Ora or whatever her name is. There's some singer and musician named Andrew Watt, and I'm not him either. And I'm not the football player either.
Yeah, I've got that problem also. There are some Eric Arnesons who are way more famous than I am, so I always have to use my middle initial also.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay.
Welcome to the 21st century.
I know, there's just have you ever seen who's it, the One? It's a movie with I can't remember the name of the guy. He's one of those like martial arts. Jet Li. I think it's Jet Li.
Jet Li.
And he has to go from universe to, or they're going from universe to universe, killing all the alternate Jet Lis. I mean, not to give anybody ideas, but
no.
All right.
But the other thing that's like that, and this is a good place to close, is the alien who goes around in his time traveling spaceship, making sure that he insults every single living entity in the universe in alphabetical order.
Oh, from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, and he comes to Dent, comma, Arthur L., and he goes, hang on, I've done you before, haven't I?
All right. Well, thank you, Andrew. Hopefully we will have you on again sometime.
That would be delightful. It was a pleasure chatting with you, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you for listening to My Alchemical Bromance. You can find us on the web at myalchemicalbromance.com. You can find us on Stitcher and iTunes and YouTube and maybe Spotify. You can support us if you'd like to. In fact, we would love for you to support us through the Arnomancy Patreon. You can find a link in the show notes or on the website. It's patreon.com/arnomancy for just $1 a month. Tune in next time and see you soon.